the general title of Vignettes of American Methodism. For the American Methodist experience reached one of its climax moments in 1784, 200 years ago, when it became a separate self-governing and directing church in America. And 200 years later, we have been celebrating and rejoicing in that heritage and tradition. We began by talking about the Wesleyan background and then turned to each of the three major stems out of which United Methodism in America has emerged. And we talked about the beginnings of the Methodist Episcopal Church in America in the work of Francis Asbury. We talked about the beginnings of the Evangelische Gemeinschaft, the Evangelical Association, in the work of Jacob Albright. And we talked last week about the beginnings of the work of the United Brethren in Christ in the work of Philip William Otterbein and Martin Bim. Now, during the rest of the summer, I intend each Sunday to talk about a different aspect of the American Methodist experience, if you will, focusing sometimes in one period and sometimes in another, but trying to get a picture of some of the themes and of some of the activities that have particularly characterized our church as it has developed in the American scene. And today, the topic is the expanding frontier. The treaty which closed the American Revolution set the western boundary of the United States of America at the Mississippi River. In 1803, the Louisiana Purchase made the western boundary of the United States the Rocky Mountains. The Mexican War of the 1840s made the western boundary of the United States the Pacific Ocean. And yet in all of the United States in 1790, the careful takers of the first American census could find only 3,100,000 persons. One of the major characteristics of American life in the 19th century then was the development and pursuit of the frontier. That is, the conquest of America, to use one set of terminology, the conquest of America by the Americans. As those folk, first, second, third generation immigrants from the Old World, began to penetrate the Allegheny barriers into the valley of the Great River, and then eventually cross the river and the plains and out across the Rockies and all the way to the West Coast. Frederick Jackson Turner, a great historian of the late 19th century, once wrote, "To study the advance to the frontier, the men and women who grew up under frontier conditions and the political, economic, and social results of the frontier is to study the truly American part of American history." Now, that's probably overstated and perhaps is too strong. There are other distinctive American influences as well as the frontier. But no modern historian would discuss the 19th century in America without some concern for the frontier effect, and that's particularly true of church historians. For the major event in American history from the American Revolution to the Civil War, the major event in American history between the Revolution and the Civil War was the conquest of the frontier, was the moving westward into the new land, the clearing of the land and the creation of institutions to support a society in the new land. In a very real sense, the churches who met the problems of the frontier most adequately, the churches who spoke most effectively to the needs of the people moving west, those would be the churches destined for largest growth numerically in American society. In 1790, there were already three major distinguishable routes or streams of immigrants moving westward. One of them began in New England, crossed the mountains of the at the Berkshire Gap, opened out into the Mohawk Valley, followed the Mohawk Valley westward, and from the Mohawk entered eventually into the basin of the Great Lakes. A second of these routes passed from Chesapeake Bay through southern Pennsylvania and Maryland, particularly through the Delaware Water Gap, and into the regions of the basin of the Ohio River and its tributaries. A third of these routes followed the Valley of Virginia to the passes over the Blue Ridge into Kentucky and Tennessee. Each of these three major routes, each of the routes being determined basically by the passes available through the mountains, each of these three major routes would burgeon, some of them in greater strength, some of them in lesser strength at particular times during the course of the next 50 years. So that it was, all of these routes would pour people into the Valley of the Ohio and the West. As a result of the early migrations, as a result of the fact that the earliest of the migrations moved out of the South rather than in through the northern portions of the gaps, it is the southern colonies in the Midwest or the southern areas in the Midwest that first became states. Thus, Kentucky and Tennessee had both become states by 1796. After the Battle of Fallen Timbers in 1794, when the Miami Confederacy of Indians was defeated, the move into the Ohio area would become substantial. And by 1800, there were 200,000 folk in Kentucky, 105,000 in Tennessee, and 45,000 in Ohio. In 1803, 3 years later, Ohio would become a state. The most intense period of westward migration began in 1808 and lasted until the return of good times about 1820. You know, migration usually is a reflection of dissatisfaction. It's usually a reflection of the fact that things are going badly here, and so those who can afford to move try to go somewhere else in hopes that they will find things a bit better there. Migration, to mention one other factor, which also needs to be kept in mind because it's a common misconception, migration usually does not involve the poorest element in the society. Simply because the poorest element in the society can't get together a poke sufficient to take them to the frontier and enable them to survive the first winter. Because you've got to carry with you supplies for the first winter if you're going to make it through the first winter. And that means you've got to have enough for, if you've got a family, you've got to have enough for a wagon, you've got to have enough for grain to plant for next year's crop, you've got to have enough to get you through that first year. Well, the very poor can't do that. The very poor have no option but to stay where they are because they can't afford to go anywhere else. The very rich don't migrate either, and that will be a factor, as we'll see here in a moment. The very rich don't migrate in general because they're well off where they are. And they're generally comfortable where they are, and therefore there is not that strong push to look for a new place to go to settle. It has been in the American experience. Generally, the lower middle class and the upper reaches of the working class who have migrated. Now, that's not an exclusive statement, it's a general statement. There are exceptions to the rule. But in general, it has been the lower middle class and the upper reaches of the working class, those who thought they had the most benefit by getting out of where they were and breaking the patterns of where they were, who have set up to move westward. Now, the churches followed and occasionally, even to a degree, led this migration. But all too often, the churches did not respond as actively or as vigorously as ideally they might. This is particularly true of some of the largest of the denominations of the colonial period. The Anglican Church in America, for instance, had been the fourth largest denomination at the time of the American Revolution. They did not effectively move into the frontier areas as one perhaps might have expected. Indeed, the Anglicans had trouble just surviving the Revolution without worrying too much about where they might go after the Revolution was over. The Anglican Church was so firmly identified, of course, with the cause of the king, or at least many of its ministers were so firmly identified with the cause of the king, that there were some of its leadership who wondered whether the church could ever come back after the war was over. The Anglican tradition in America began as an established church. That is, as a church which gained a regular part of its ministerial support from a land tax paid by all of the citizens, whether they were active church members or not. Now, when you move from an established church to a voluntary church, from a pattern in which you have the support of the tax system to a pattern where the voluntary gifts of a congregation who has not been trained to voluntarism provide all the money you're going to work on, survival becomes very much an issue. the fourth largest denomination at the time of the outbreak of the revolution, as we have suggested, it would be the seventh largest denomination 50 years later. It would lose ground steadily for the first 20 years and then slowly begin to gather steam once again. In 1801, after 18 years of backbreaking effort, one of their first bishops, Bishop Prevost, gave up and retired to the community, retired to the country, saying, in effect, it's hopeless. We simply can't regain or recreate this denomination in the American scene. A part of the problem was the class to which the Anglican Church had gauged its appeal generally, the colonial landholding aristocracy of the southern colonies, was not the class that was moving. It was the middle class and the working class that were moving. And those folk generally were not Anglican, or if they were Anglican, they were likely to be of the Methodist branch of Anglicanism. For Methodism in its earliest days was, of course, a part of that Anglican establishment. Moreover, the highly liturgical service of Thomas Cranmer was little well adapted to the frontier. Basically, the Anglican Church service, for its effective use and effective development, assumes either that the whole congregation has a prayer book in its hand or that the whole congregation has the basic anthems of the ancient church in its mind. Thus, the assumption on the part of an Anglican minister when he got up in front of a congregation was that when he called for the Te Deum or when he called for the Venite, that the congregation could recite the Te Deum or the Venite. Well, that simply wasn't true on the frontier. Moreover, if they had one copy of the prayer book, they were doing well. And Mr. Xerox had not yet put a copying machine in every corner drugstore. The Congregationalists, who had been the largest denomination in the colonial period, were scarcely better off. In 1760, Ezra Stiles, a Congregational historian, wrote a discourse on church union. In that discourse, he predicted that there should be, by 1850 or thereabouts, that there should be approximately 7 million Congregationalists in America. He said that's simply natural growth, reproduction, plus the growth that one would expect by a moderate evangelism. He was wrong by 6¾ million, which may be a sign you shouldn't trust church historians, I'm not sure. This failure is partly due to the fact that the Puritan aristocracy of New England, who made up a large part of the congregational meeting and congregational leadership, stayed at home. They were comfortable in New England. There was no reason for them to leave. And a large part of a sizable portion of that colonial aristocracy were the clergy. That is, they were clergy who had state support, who had the assurance of a living, of a salary, of a building in which to hold their services, and of a parsonage in which to live. Why should they go out and risk the dangers of the frontier? It wasn't that they weren't open to the idea of mission. They had a mission right there. All you have to do is look at the contemporary newspaper accounts of the city of Boston to realize there was ample work for ministers to do in Boston. But in any case, the congregational constituency, both the lay constituency who paid the bills of the church and the clerical constituency who headed the churches, had little reason to move to the West. Moreover, around the turn of the century in American congregational life, the congregational church was in the process of going through the major schism of its history, as the schism between Trinitarian Congregationalism and Unitarianism. And at a time when the church itself was being rent apart on a theological issue, there were not enough pastors coming out of Yale and Harvard to pastor the churches in New England, much less to send large numbers of missionaries to the Middle West. When I say not enough pastors coming out of Yale and Harvard, that's another factor, if you will. The Congregationalists clung to the ideal of a highly educated ministry. They would not ordain anyone to the ministry who had not been a college graduate, or at least they ordained as few as they could. That meant that the number of ministerial candidates was always small, and the encouragement of lay preachers who had not had the opportunity of college was virtually eliminated. Presbyterians were better able to meet the challenge. For one thing, they were already located on the boundaries of the frontier. Presbyterian settlements in America and their strength at the time of the Revolution were the Piedmont or Highland areas of Virginia, North Carolina, and Maryland, and Pennsylvania mountains. In these areas, as early as 1785, there had been Presbyterian churches begun. By 1802, there were three presbyteries and one synod on the west side of the Allegheny Mountains. And by 1820, there were 2,700 Presbyterians in Kentucky. It's an impressive figure, until one realizes that in the same year, there were 21,000 Methodists in Kentucky and 21,000 Baptists in Kentucky. Quite clearly, the two churches who most grew in the frontier areas were the Baptists and the Methodists. The secret of their success was largely organizational and partly theological. A word about the Baptists, and then we'll come to the Methodists. The Baptists developed a unique and characteristic institution. That is an institution which effectively undertook the missionary exploitation or expansion into the frontier areas. That institution is what is usually called the farmer evangelist. Now, the operation of the farmer evangelist works this way. A farmer who has a family, who moves from the areas of the eastern seaboard into the frontier areas in hopes of finding broader acres, broader lands, and a more comfortable opportunity, arrives, clears the trees to a degree at least, plants his fields. After 2 or 3 years, apparently he's going to make it. Things are going relatively well. He's producing enough to sell, to buy what he has to buy, and the rest of it he can eat himself. At least that's the theory. But this is a minister, this is a farmer migrant, unlike most of the farmer migrants, in that there is on his heart a strong burden and a strong sense of an obligation to proclaim the gospel and share the truth of Jesus Christ with those whom he knows. It becomes natural for him, as other settlers settle within a 4, 5, 6 mile radius, to on given days invite those settlers to come in for a preaching service in his home on Sunday morning. A church is formed, a congregation established. The congregation is, of course, establishing itself. There is no outside hierarchical structure. And they turn to the man who was their initial preacher to become their pastor. If they ordain anybody, if he is ordained at all, he is ordained by that local church, because there's nobody else around to ordain him. And with the passage of a few months or a few years, perhaps a new log cabin building will be built as a church building, usually on a corner of the land or the farm that belongs to the farmer evangelist. And that's crucial, because it means that the property of the church often was owned by its pastor. It becomes very difficult to change pastors in that situation. These self-supporting evangelists work 6 days a week in the fields, and the seventh day they preach the gospel. Now, it might be 3 days and 4 days on certain seasons of the year. When the demands of the fields were not so great, he would spend longer on pastoral calling and the like. These pastors were generally without much formal education. Indeed, among them, there was a strongly anti-intellectual prejudice discernible. Some years ago, I was down in the Middle South in Tennessee, attended a high school graduation service, and there was asked by the head of the school if I would have a conversation with one of the boys in the school who was a young man of very considerable intellectual ability, and she had been trying to encourage him to go on to college, had suggested various vocations to him, one of which was the possibility of the ministry. And she asked me if I would talk to him a bit about the educational provisions and what have you for persons who wanted to go into the ministry. Well, this young Baptist layman was very polite and very kind in his conversation with me. But when we got done to the end of the conversation, his response essentially was, "But Dr. Brown, the real point is, If I have a call for the ministry, I don't need an education. And if I don't have a call to the ministry, all the education in the world isn't going to help. Well, there is a kind of an anti-intellectualism that is characteristic of this Baptist heritage or Baptist tradition. The young men were then laymen who local congregation recognized their genius and their spirit, and who sanctified that by ordination. A young man with a glib tongue would be encouraged to preach. His local church would license him. When chosen to head a regular congregation, he would be fully ordained. The theological position was generally a mild Calvinism. Once organized, the churches would hold monthly business sessions. And when you read the minutes of these meetings, it's quite clear that a major part of the business session was given over to the disciplining of the members. Charges such as drinking, fighting, gossiping, lying, stealing, immoral sexual relations, beating your wife or beating your husband, gambling, horse racing, and the like. Quite clearly, the church was not a community of saints, but of saints and sinners. The beginning meeting place at first, as we've said, was the cabin of the preacher. A year or two later, a meeting house of round logs would be built nearby. And if it prospered, this would be followed by a house of hewn logs and of chimney of brick. To the building of such a structure, Thomas Lincoln contributed the labor of himself and his 10-year-old son, Abraham, in Pigeon Creek, Indiana, in 1819. Now, by all odds, the most successful of the American churches on the frontier were the Methodists. Both their doctrine and their organization united to become a remarkably effective missionary evangelistic undertaking. Their adaptability was remarkable. Theologically, the gospel of the Methodists, alone among the major denominations that went to the frontier, was a gospel that focused upon the freedom of the individual to make choices as to whether they would become children of God and obedient to God or not. The Presbyterians and the congregation, both, and the Baptists to a somewhat lesser degree, emphasized the doctrine of predestination. That is, emphasized the idea that salvation is a matter of God's choice before all time, determining or predetermining that certain ones should be saved and certain ones should not. Now, if you really believe that God has already determined before the beginning of time who shall be saved and who shall not be, evangelistic preaching loses a certain amount of its verve and a certain amount of its effect. Because preaching really does no good in the sense that whether the person hears the preaching or not, he's going to be saved if he was predestined to be saved. And no matter how much preaching he is going to he hears, he's going to be damned if he was predestined to be damned. Now, we would have to say that the Frontier Presbyterians and Congregationalists welched a little bit upon this, and they talked about a number of mediating factors that might affect one's salvation. But I think it is quite clear that the Methodist doctrine of free will, of the free response of the individual believer to the gospel proclaimed, that the Methodist doctrine of free will is one of the reasons for the Methodist success upon the frontier. The frontiersman wanted to believe that indeed he was the master of his destiny. And the Methodist doctrine suggested that as far as his relationship with God was concerned, indeed he was. Oh, of course, the Methodist said there is no salvation without God's grace. All the free will preachers taught that. The point was that when God offers his grace, the predestinarian said we have nothing to do but to accept. That is, we have no other choice than to accept or to reject that choice having been predetermined by God. While the Methodist said you have the choice to go one way or the other. And they told the frontiersmen, in a sense, what the frontiersmen wanted to believe, that they were the masters of their own destiny, religiously. The wheel horse and the real key to the system was the traveling minister or circuit rider, and here the difference from the Baptists is substantial. The primary institutional form of the Baptist conquest of the West was the resident farmer preacher. The primary Methodist institution was the circuit rider or circuit traveler. The circuit riders were a superbly mobile force. The intention was that they should be ready to go anywhere, anytime. No settlement was to be too remote. No place was to be too run down for them to preach the gospel. The circuits were sometimes very large indeed, and they changed from year to year, sometimes almost from month to month. Some years ago, and this was late in the history of the circuit movement, but nevertheless, some years ago, a district superintendent called upon one of his pastors to report how many churches he had in his circuit this year, and the pastor responded, there were 14. And the district superintendent, running down the records, said, but there were only 12 last year. Did you found two more? No, he said, I found two that had been lost by the preceding pastor. That is, either because the trip was too long or because he didn't know how to get there, he had just misplaced a couple of preaching stations out there along the edge of the circuit. Well, the circuits were very large, and the pastors traveled on them virtually constantly. Circuits of 40 and 50 and 60 preaching places were not uncommon at all. The Cherry Valley Circuit in northeastern Ohio had at one period in its life the 43 preaching appointments. Now, the 43 preaching appointments obviously are not going to be preached at every day or every Sunday. The pastor works his way around the circuit. He begins up here and he makes his way around. And the theory is that in a course of approximately 7 weeks, 6 weeks, half of a quarter, he will have gotten around half of it. And he'll get around the other half in the remaining portion of the quarter. This may very well mean for given pastors that they are on the road 9 days out of 10. And the maintenance of family life, or the maintenance of the married relationship and the affections that go with that relationship are very difficult. Bishop Asbury never married. He did not believe it was wise for Methodist preachers to marry. In 1809, of the 84 preachers in the Virginia Conference, only three were married. No conditions were too severe for these brethren. They roughed it along the trails in snow and in rain. They put up at local farm homes when it was possible, and when it wasn't possible, they slept out. They spent a good part of their lives hungry and wet and cold and verminous and eternally saddle sore, and most of them died young. Of the 737 conference members who had died by 1847, that is roughly 50, 60 years after the foundation, of the 737 conference members who had died by 1847, 203 were between the ages of 25 and 35 when they died. Another 121 were between the ages of 35 and 45. So that half of the number died before 45. Now, life expectancy was not as high in those days. And the immediate reaction may be, well, average life expectancy was somewhere in the neighborhood of the mid-40s. But these are not average persons that you can put up against average life expectancy. These are persons who have grown to adulthood in good health before they decide to become ministers. That is, they decide to become ministers, most of them in their late teens and early 20s, and are in reasonably good health, or the church wouldn't accept them. Now, when one says that of a group of 737 persons who became ministers between the ages, let us say, of 18 and 22, that 203 were dead between the ages of 25 and 35, the statistical price of the revival begins to become a bit clearer. If they lived long, and some of them did, they could expect an old age of rheumatism and dyspepsia. And $64 a year, as the conference so graciously put it, for worn-out preachers. A folk saying indicated their tenacity. When the blizzards howled and when the rain pelted down, when the hurricane was making its impact, then folk would say, nobody's out tonight but crows and Methodist preachers. And yet they had an attitude. And they had a vision. And they had a sense of that to which they were called. Some years ago, I had a student at Boston who turned over to me a copy of a little poem, and I want to read to you the covering note and then read to you the poem. My grandfather was a circuit rider in Kansas in the early part of this century. He started riding on Saturday evening and rode all night, guided by his knowledge of the stars and the topography. He preached at his first parish at 8 o'clock a.m. the next Sunday morning, on Sunday morning, 54 miles away from where he lived. He then worked his way back home, preaching at each of six parishes on his way. He would arrive home very late Sunday evening. One congregation was a group of cowboys that he met out on the plains, and he occasionally preached to a tribe of Sioux Indians. Before he died, he wrote an autobiography, which is still mainly in longhand. This poem was one of his favorites, and although he always said the author was anonymous, we have reason to believe he wrote it himself. And I pass it along to you because it provides an interesting insight into the psyche of the Methodist circuit rider in the West in the early 1900s. I'd rather be a pine on a windswept timber line than any oak or elm down below. Just to know that I could thrive where no other could survive would repay me for the hardship and the snow. And there'd be a growing thrill as the wintry winds blew chill in the knowledge that my trunk was stout and strong, and I'd revel in the blast, knowing roots were anchored fast and the sighing of the storm would be my song. These hardy individualists of the long, long trail excited an equally hardy response and admiration from the Kentucky, Tennessee, and Ohio frontiersmen. Now, the thought will occur to some of you that in many ways they are like the Baptist frontier preachers, and indeed in tenacity they are, in lack of education they are, because these young men were not graduates of college and seminary either. But they differed in four important ways from the Baptists. First, they kept at it full time, 365 days of the year. They served circuits that took sometimes months to round. They preached daily or nearly so, where the Baptist preacher normally preached in the chapel down there on the corner of his own farm once a week. Secondly, the church supported them. Not very well, but it supported them. $64 a year and all they could eat on the road, and the wives of their parishioners would provide them with clothing and socks and what have you as they went from place to place, presuming that they were attractive enough in their preaching. Delightful story told of one young man who was theologically trained and found that his theological education in times got in trouble with his communication with his congregation. There were two ministers assigned to this particular circuit, and he said the only reason he survived was because his colleague, who had no theological education, shared the socks with him that the ladies knit. Thirdly, they changed regularly. The Methodist preachers itinerated regularly, and every year a new man was appointed to the circuit. They did not suffer from a Baptist situation where a pastor who should move didn't move, or where a congregation found itself, quote, stuck with a man, close quote, because after all, he owned the building. And what are you going to do about it? So it was. The Methodists came, they said their word, they were gone, and if you didn't like a particular one, it was a matter of waiting a little while. Fourthly, they were part of a well-disciplined force. They were chosen by presiding elders. They were regularly tested by those presiding elders. Their circuits were regularly visited at quarterly conference time by presiding elder or bishop. Their reward was a harvest of souls and a solid connectional organization. Circuit riders rarely got enough of a following in one year in one particular circuit to encourage them to schism or to encourage them to go off on their own. The episcopacy gave unity to it all. And that unity rested in persons like Bishop Asbury and Bishop McKendry, who worked themselves as hard as their men were worked. In the course of his travels, some of you heard me say a couple weeks ago, Bishop Asbury visited New York State over 50 times, New York, New Jersey 60 times, Pennsylvania 78, Maryland 80, North Carolina 63, South Carolina 46, Virginia 84, Tennessee and Georgia 20 each, and Massachusetts 23 times. In all of those travels, there is not a single recorded reservation on the Allegheny commuter. It was all done on horseback, and it was done slowly. But what the effect of it was to bring the brass, as it were, into direct contact with those who were doing the work on the frontier. And if, as a local preacher, you were occasionally inclined to feel, I have it awfully rough, if you looked at your bishop, you would discover he had it rougher and was working harder. The system of circuit rider and episcopal leadership was still further strengthened by an emphasis upon local lay preachers. Every class meeting was headed by a layman or laywoman. A young man who gave evidence of ability at speaking would be urged by his class leader to exercise those gifts before the class. If he was well received, he would be licensed as an exhorter. If he was well received as an exhorter, he would be licensed as a local preacher, that is, to preach in between the times when the circuit rider wasn't there. And if he was successful as a local preacher, he might very well become ordained as a traveling elder. Now, if Methodism's characteristic tool or instrument was the circuit rider, it can be equally said that the characteristic means of all of the successful frontier churches, including the Methodists, was the camp meeting. The need for a renewed emphasis upon vital religion was widely felt in the years following the American Revolution. The concentration on the war and the decline of the colonial church's vital form, the prevalence of deism, all seemed to call for a revival in the minds of religious leaders. We who more or less take it for granted that 50 to 60% of the population of the United States are going to be members of churches, they aren't going to be all there any Sunday morning. If they were, God knows what we'd do with them. But we take it for granted that there's about 50 to 60% of our population that are at least interested enough to become members. May find it shocking to realize that in 1790, less than 10% of the population of America were members of churches, and that the survival of the church was very much in question. The so-called Second Great Awakening is thus usually said to have begun on the East Coast shortly after the Revolution, with the relatively quiet penetration of New England by the Methodists in 1789. From New England, it spread to the Middle States, but on the East Coast, the Second Awakening took the form of a relatively quiet, church-centered evangelistic campaign. The Eastern phase of the Second Awakening was then a rather quiet affair. The Western phase was something else again. For there, a kind of godly hysteria crackled across the frontier from 1800 to 1820, which set institutionalism revivalism at the heart of the frontier churches. And that train hasn't burned itself out yet. This binge of unharnessed emotionalism, which followed, far outstripped the surprising happenings that Jonathan Edwards had described in the 1730s and 40s at Northampton. And it left lasting marks on American Protestantism, particularly in the form of a tradition of unpolished, hell-for-leather preaching by men or women of little education, but enormous zest, enormous vigor, enormous consciousness of the Spirit of God. The established churches embraced these ideas and these forms and heritages and made them a part of the American religious heritage, and they've never been quite the same since. The camp meeting began under Presbyterian auspices in the Cumberland Hills of Kentucky. There, one James McGrady had been invited to leave his North Carolina parish and come to Kentucky as a preacher. Now, I say he had been invited to leave the North Carolina parish, and the immediate response to that is that the Kentucky parish had invited him. It wasn't quite that way. Rather, it was the North Carolina parish that invited him. And the way in which they invited him to leave was to take his pulpit out of his church and burn it on the front yard of his parsonage. He is also said to have received a letter written in blood suggesting the time had come to itinerate. In any case, he moved to Kentucky, and there he began to exercise his powers of language in Logan County. We are told that a general awakening was in progress by 1799 in Logan County, and the following year, after substantial advance publicity, a planned preaching time at Gasper River proved to be the beginning of the camp meeting experience. Settlers came from as far away as 100 miles. That's almost a week's travel in that day. The householders at Gasper River, there were only about 75 of them, couldn't possibly house the several hundred who showed up. And the folk who were coming knew that. And so they brought their wagons, and in their wagons were sleeping rolls, enough food for 3 or 4 days, and the other supplies they would need while they were traveling. The settlers thus brought tents and provisions to stay 3 days, and the result was the first camp meeting. Now, the motives for people attending camp meeting were, of course, mixed. Some came to see and be seen. It was the most important social event on the frontier. Some came to electioneer for popularity. The politicians were always at the camp meetings. Some came because it was the best opportunity to see one's friends and one's relations that the year would provide. Some came seeking husbands, and some came seeking wives. And as I have said on other occasions, the number of unexpected pregnancies among the virgins presumptive in attendance was high enough to cause one observer to remark that sometimes at least there were more souls begot than saved. Some came because it was the best show on the frontier. Peter Cartwright wrote, "To see proud young gentlemen and their ladies dressed in their silks, jewelry, and prunella from top to toe take the jerks would often excite my risibilities." Now, the jerks are uncontrollable physical manifestations in which the muscles go all like this and the body goes back and forth and snaps and what have you. The first jerk or so, you would see their fine bonnets, caps, and combs fly, and so sudden would be the jerking of the head that their long, loose hair would crack almost as loud as a wagoneer's whip. Now, I wouldn't want to suggest that Peter Cartwright, a Methodist district superintendent, exaggerated just a bit, but I have never heard hair crack like a wagoneer's whip. When all of this has been said, however, one has to say that finally, with all of the motives that are there, some came, and perhaps most came, seeking a miracle. They came to the camp meeting seeking to be made a Christian. They came to the camp meeting seeking to be born again. God could, if he would, convert one in a flash. He'd done it to Paul. He'd done it to Isaiah. God could, if he would, convert 3,000 at a time. He did it at Pentecost. God could, if he would, shower his blessings upon an entire congregation, and when he did, what a miraculous season followed. The excitement at Gasper River in the summer of 1800 engendered a still greater meeting, perhaps the greatest of the era, the following year at Cane Ridge, where contemporary estimates suggest a minimum of 10,000 and perhaps a maximum of 25,000 attended the meeting. Now, the reason for that big a variation is because people have different bases upon which to make estimates. But the reason also is a reflection of the fact that the meeting went on for a little over a week. And during that time, there were big crowds some of the time and small crowds some of the time. Technically Presbyterian in its sponsorship, they were numerous Baptists and Methodists there too. Preaching stands were set up, two of them 150 yards or so apart. All the underbrush was cleared out from under the trees. The wagons that brought the people who were attended then formed a great open oval around those two preaching areas and the trees in between the preaching areas. The backs of the wagons were backed in towards the preaching area, and at the back of each wagon during the course of the time, and particularly at night, there would be a great fire for cooking and for the lighting of the area inside so that the preaching could go on day and night. And the activity did indeed go on 24 hours a day. Preaching began more or less in an orderly manner at each of the two preaching places 150 yards apart, with one group there and one group there. But then as other folk began to feel the move to preach or the inspiration to preach, they would look for a local tree stump and climb up on top of it and begin to proclaim or exhort as they felt desirable. And sometimes there would be 7 or 8 or even 9 or 10 preachers all preaching at once at full volume. Conversions went on day and night for a week, and conversions and physical collapse seemed to have been on all sides. When a person collapsed, he was carried to one side, where one of the ministers would kneel and pray with him for a time, and his friends would gather about him to sing a suitable hymn. An observer reports seeing what he calls 100 candles burning all at once. Now, what he means by candles burning is 100 persons in one or another of the stages of conversion on the floor of the assembly. Over 1,000 of those who attended professed conversion at the end of the week. Those who were at Cane Ridge then went forth to spread the gospel using the new method happily and enthusiastically. In 1811, Bishop Asbury estimated there were 400 camp meetings in various parts of the West, and no one denomination had more than the Methodists. For the Methodists seized upon the camp meeting as a tool and as a technique appropriate for and appropriate to the needs of the frontier. The results of the camp meetings have been and will continue to be endlessly debated. Those who are horrified point to manifest immorality on the part of many of the attendants. They point to habits of impulsive action fostered by the revivals. They point out the outrageous extremes of emotionalism, and they point out the endless schisms and counter-schisms, particularly among the Presbyterians. Those who on the whole favor the movement speak of the social outlet provided in the frontier situation. They talk about the moral improvement of the newly converted, and that moral improvement was substantial. And they talk about the influence for good of the newly converted on their communities and the enlargement of the churches who sponsored the meetings. One does not have to decide here, I trust, between the pros and the cons of the camp meeting movement. If we do have to decide it, I have a feeling that 6 minutes isn't quite enough time. But this at least I think we should say. The camp meeting was ready-made for Methodism, and Methodism took it to its bosom. The Methodist theology was Arminian. They could preach conversion with a genuineness hard to manage among the Calvinists. The Methodists, moreover, had no hidebound East Coast seaboard connection that would be constantly titch-titching because of the excessive emotionalism. One of the problems the Presbyterians had was that the old-line Scotch-Irish churches of the Eastern Seaboard were much distressed by what they heard going on in the Midwest, and they tried to stop it. And that resulted, of course, in schism. The Methodist organization was ideally suited to make Methodism a transmission belt for religious values to the West. For the annual camp meeting in a given circuit became a regular way in which the circuit became conscious of itself and the community became conscious of its obligation to serve others. Every coming of the circuit rider was, in a sense, a little revival. Moreover, the Methodists were not afraid of emotion. They were more, as were the more conservative Presbyterians. Both in England and in America, the Methodists were fighting what they called the heartless, cold formality of established religion. They expected remarkable things to happen. And when they happened, they didn't ask too many questions about them. By 1850, the frontier was well past the Mississippi River and still moving west. But the statistical evidence points the moral. The Methodists, who had been the smallest denomination in America with 15,000 members in 1783, were now the largest Protestant denomination in America with 1,324,000 members. 15,000 to 1,324,000 in less than 60 years. The Baptists, who had ranked third in 1783, are now second largest with 815,000 members. The Presbyterians, who had been second, are now third with 487,000 members. And the Congregationalists who had been first are now fourth with 197,000 members. The Lutherans held their fifth position with 163,000. And the Disciples of Christ, a totally new frontier denomination created from nothing, have now become the sixth largest with 118,000. And the Episcopalians, who had been fourth in 1783, are now seventh with 90,000. In short, the numerical importance of the churches, that is, the long-run numerical importance of the churches, was determined in large part by the effectiveness with which each of them met the problems of the people moving west.